Thanks a lot, Renato. Thanks for coming at this early hour. I sort of want to follow up on Omar's talk, but also talk a bit about some motivation from sort of this field between holography, quantum gravity, and quantum information theory. So maybe what I'll do first is actually I'll write down a formula that I think Omar wrote down in his talk, basically quantifying this monotonicity of the relative entropy. And then I want to make some statements about this. Then I will talk a bit about the general motivation, about this bulk reconstruction problem. And then we'll come back sort of to talk about quantum error correction and these recovery maps. So I guess the formula that Omar wrote down is something like this. So suppose we want sigma two states. E is a quantum channel. Then I suppose this was minus 2 log fidelity between rho. And now here, basically, the idea is that we apply this map E to rho, and now there's a recovery map that acts on the output. And crucially, this recovery map, it may depend on the channel E. It may depend on the state sigma, but it will not depend on rho. I guess that's the form, that is a formula, a hopefully correct formula that you also wrote down. So the point is, in particular, if relative entropy is exactly preserved, then we can recover the output of the channel for, on the stage rho. Even though, so, and some of, I mean, I guess maybe let me actually give you an example. Suppose this equality held for a fixed state sigma, maybe a maxi mixed state, and all many states rho. Then this would be very useful because we could sort of think of epsilon of E as an error channel, a channel that introduces errors, and R will be a map that undoes these errors, right? Because if the left-hand side is exactly zero, this fidelity will be one, so a rho will actually be equal to R of E of rho. And because this map does not depend on rho, we can use it for this unknown output state, E of rho, for any rho. Okay, so maybe I'll just write this, I'll write this down here. So we can think of this as giving a sort of a quantitative version an approximate version of a kind of quantum error correction. So suppose E is a channel that introduces errors. And so then what I said is that if these relative entropies are approximately preserved, then it will follow that R E of rho is approximately rho. And again, this map is universal, so this is why these things, why it's important that it's a universal recovery map in this scenario. Okay, very good. So maybe I'll just say independent. So that's somewhat of one motivation. So I guess this combines these two words in the title.
You said something about the choice of sigma, which you didn't.
Yes. So I was being loose here. Suppose you had this statement for some fixed sigma, but many different rows, and this will be the context in which this will appear. For example, suppose that sigma is something like a maxi mixed state on some code subspace, and the rows are arbitrary code states. Then somehow, if you had this requirement for all rho, you could use this universal recovery map, which now only depends on the code, on the code space, on this maxi mixed space that we chose to this reference state. So we can sort of think of this maybe as a fixed reference state, and the rho is something that changes. And only of course, if we have this condition for many rows, we get some interesting result because we could always construct a map R that works for a specific rho.
Is one supposed to think of this as sort of just extracting the information, but perhaps at the cost of demolishing the original or really preserve it, restoring?
I think it depends. So if this only held, I mean, so in principle, this is really somewhere, for example, in the fidelity or in the trace norm. So you get the state back, but I guess it's more interesting if it works for many rows at once. That's really the original state you feed in.
Okay,
so this row. So you really recover the state. Yeah. So you can sort of do it afresh. You can apply epsilon E again. Do something else, maybe then something more interesting to row. Yes, that's right. Maybe I also would like. So we'll come back to this point in a more precise fashion. Maybe I also want to say that somewhere there was this explicit formula for R that I think Omar alluded to or gave, which was in terms of these rotated hex maps, which I will not write down. But I want to say that if one like, one could interpret this formula for R as a quantum version of the Bayes rule. So there's a certain way of writing down the classical Bayes rule, which is also solving such an inverse problem, such a sort of a partial inversion problem. And if one, you know, in quantum, we always have these operator ordering issues. So there's a specific way of writing it down, such when you plug in density operators, you basically recover a form of this recovery map. Especially, let me say, maybe I'll just use somewhat vague is a quantum version of Bayes rule. And so you can look at our paper if you want to sort of see a derivation. A more formal statement, we make it we actually express it as a statement about the choice state of the recovery map, which can be written in a certain form. But the form is roughly as follows. So if you'll remember Bayes rules are something like this. If you have a say a probability distribution P of X and a channel of that from X to Y, then we kind of want to know something like an inverse channel. So we want to define a channel from Y to X, which is a conditional probability distribution. And sort of Bayes rule basically states the following thing. So this is the joint distribution. Now we divide by P of Y, we get an object like this. So somehow this is a topology, if you like. But the way to think about it is basically that this is our channel E. I have some colors here. Oh. So this is like E. I guess this is like the state sigma, if you like. This is then E of sigma. And so now you could imagine that there would be a way of, you know, sort of writing down a quantum version that somehow worries about the operator ordering in the right way. And I'll write down just another way, sort of as inspiration. So one way of writing down this formula in sort of an overly complicated, well, seemingly overly complicated way would be as follows. Like P of Y over P of X. You perturb it slightly by this channel. Now you take a derivative. Now this is the form in which, I mean, roughly speaking, if in this form you plugged in sigma and E of sigma, again, I'll refer you to this paper, then you can actually, that's maybe another way of interpreting this rotated PETS map, which we found nice to think about. So maybe this is just an aside. So now I'll want to sort of start talking about this bulk reconstruction problem as a bit of motivation. Are there any questions about this? So this is maybe, yeah.
Sorry, you said that it's like a rotated PETS map, but by that you mean this map that was explicitly shown to be...
One good choice of R.
The explicit map that's upper bounded by the CMI.
I mean actually this recovery map in the relative entropy scenario. Sorry, not. I don't mean the case in the CMI. I'm not sure which formula Omar wrote down. I'm thinking about this guy. Like there's an explicit formula of this guy, right? An integral dt, some mixture of rotated things.
That's right.
That's the object I have in mind, and you could obtain it basically by a quantization of this formula, if you like. And so that's in this sense you can think of it as a quantum version of Bayes' rule. I'll leave it as an, maybe we can talk. I mean, it's sort of really not central to this talk, but I guess I wanted to intrigue you. Sorry.
I saw this formula now for the first time. I'm just puzzled by it, but maybe, yes, if it's not central to the talk.
I'll say a more formal statement. So if you write down the choice state of the recovery map, then this will be a bipartite state. So what you do is basically do something like a sigma to the inverse tensor E of sigma here, and on the right-hand side there's the choice state of the channel, and you do this derivative and you get exactly the recovery map. That's the technical statement.
But the way that map was found was not through, there were no logs or anything like that, right? It was using these tricks.
So that seems like a great way of like trying to find a different derivation, maybe closer in spirit to, you know, something crazy. I mean, we certainly learned this formula, this expansion formula for the logarithm that looks like a, you know, integral over dt. That's sort of something like this, basically this matrix logarithm derivative, it has this derivative of a matrix logarithm has this form. But that's, enough intriguing. Good. No, I'm very happy to talk about this more. But I guess it gives you some intuition why this form, why such a formula should exist, and why maybe another way to think about it. Okay, so now I'll.
So can you say something about based on the fidelity statement? Can you say something about how much you would expect to recover the measurement of some operator on the state? For example, say the difference of the relative entropy is epsilon.
Yes.
Then you have some bound, some statement.
Yeah, I mean, basically you can turn this fidelity bound into a bound on the one trace norm, on the one norm, and then you know that all observables will be, measurements of all observables will be some epsilon close.
So that's the same epsilon as the...
It's the same epsilon as in the trace norm bound,
yes.
which you can obtain from the fidelity. By Fuchs van der Graaff inequalities, I think is what they're called. Right? So you could sort of further lower bound this by some function of, it's a trace norm or trace norm squared, I forget.
So in the cases that this is not, so you could turn this into a trace norm bound, right?
Yeah.
But you could not turn it into relative entropy, which means that somehow the counterexamples are the cases where Pinsker is not tight.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that's probably fair to say, yeah. But somehow for doing measurements, in the end, the operational, the relevant quantity is, if you just looked at expectation of observables, the relevant norm would be the one norm. The relative entropy would be, in some asymmetric hypothesis testing scenario, that would be the right figure of merit, in which one should see a discrepancy between these two scenarios. But if you care about sort of computing observables, then that's let me say, fidelity or one norm. And these are good norms.
Just maybe as a remark or question, so maybe Omar showed some examples which probably showed, or I don't know if you showed them, that indeed that you're right, that if you replace this by the relative entropy, then it cannot be true. I don't know if you showed.
Yes. I understood that it was sort of a numerical example, so if there were some crazy constants, do we know
it could be
1/1000, and then maybe it evolves up until the computers become faster. Right. So I guess, so the motivation is this maybe a CFT duality, and you will notice that I'll sort of give you a cartoon of this, duality sort of from a quantum information theorist perspective. So, all the experts in the audience are very much invited to correct me and help me out. So in a sense, I guess the way I want to present this, I want to say, what is it? In the conference we saw many pictures that kind of looked like this. And then people drew curves and they did various things. I will do the same. So the point, if you like, is that there's an assertion or a conjecture or a hypothesis that the two physical theories are equivalent. So one is a conformal field theory in, say, d plus one dimensions, and the other is some kind of quantum gravity in one higher dimension. And I guess now the question is, what does it mean? As I understand, sort of the original formulation was in terms of the equivalence of two partition functions. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about it. So let's, but somehow now we have sort of a larger dictionary, and I want to sort of mention some things that are important for this talk. Okay, so you could say operationally, what does it mean to have a duality, as well as the sort of two physical theories, and you somehow know how to calculate things, questions in one theory using the other theory, for example. So that might be an operational way of thinking about it. Okay, so again, I mentioned something like. If I sort of cartoonishly write this as the equivalence of two partition functions, where now, of course, we are allowed to play around with parameters. So in this gravity theory, there will be boundary conditions. In the CFT, there will be corresponding source terms and so on. But that's one way how you could say two theories are equivalent. So maybe I'll just think of these maybe just as some set of parameters. We won't need to go into details. But if you had such a statement, then you could compare these two theories, right? This would be one possible ingredient in such a dictionary. Now, I guess that's maybe something that's a bit something that in confirmation theory people don't think about as often, partition functions and you know such an equivalence. We like to think about states, mapping between states, observables. Of course, there's relations. And so now I guess in the rest, so I want to discuss some of these more sort of quantum information here, kinematic ways, parts of this dictionary. Okay. And so maybe I should explain this picture. What does this picture mean? So that's supposed to be a time slice of ADS3. So it's a two-dimensional hyperbolic disk on this boundary. This boundary corresponds to a time slice of a 1 plus 1 dimensional of this 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory. So the cartoon goes, the CFT, say, lives on the circle and everything which is at infinity, but we don't care. And this gravity theory somehow lives in the so-called bulk in the middle. Okay. So there will be, for example, a local CFT operator would maybe live somewhere here, O of x, and a local operator in this gravity, in this bulk theory, maybe will live somewhere here. Okay. But somehow, of course, this picture is only true somehow. This is not somehow, some of this duality, some of the fact that there's, or maybe another way to say, sort of, in order to draw such a picture, I've sort of assumed that there's some fixed geometry in this bulk, okay, and so that's actually already sort of part of somehow I have to say something before I can draw this picture, and so I guess a statement that is not wrong would be to say that for certain states in this conformal field theory, certain sort of nice semi-classical states in this conformal field theory have a description where somehow this dual geometry, some of this geometry that fills in the middle, is roughly speaking fixed. And roughly speaking, there's a local, an ordinary quantum field theory on this background, and we can then map correlation functions. I guess that's a statement maybe that no one would disagree, I hope. So let me maybe write this as follows. Certain CFT states, for example, the vacuum states of these theories, have a description in terms of, say, classical log geometry plus a local QFT on top. Right. So now this sort of corresponds to this picture. So here I'm thinking about maybe a certain state or a certain family of states, maybe the ground state of some CFT in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and maybe some few lowly excited states. And dually, somehow, I have this hyperbolic disk geometry, which, again, is a time slice of ADS. And on top of this, there's quantum fields and some of these fields operators. Okay. So now, I guess this picture, at least sort of superficially speaking, makes sense. Maybe I should say that I will tell the sort of story and this motivation, and then I will try to give sort of a, I'll write down sort of a rigorously sort of well-defined toy setup that reflects part of this picture, and then we'll do some error correction and recovery and so on. So if you feel sort of uncomfortable that these things are not as precise as you'd like them, maybe bear with me and see this as inspiration. Okay. Yes.
Ask what you meant by, so when you say fixed, you want to restrict to considering sort of static geometry. Is that what you identify as fixed?
When I said fixed, I guess I meant that if you looked at sort of vastly different CFT states, they might correspond to different bulk geometries. And so when I said that's maybe all I meant when I said fixed. Maybe I want to say maybe we look at families of states that we can as living on the same geometry, maybe ground state.
That geometry
in principle, I guess could be static or could be not. For everything I'll say, let's assume they're static. So write down the Ryu-Takanagi formula and so on. But what I really meant is kind of that in some sense this picture is a state-dependent picture. If you had, for example, as the story goes, if there's a thermal state on the boundary, then we would expect that this dual geometry is not empty ADS, but rather that there's something like a black hole sitting in the middle. Or maybe if we can purify this, we get these wormhole stories and so on. So in some sense, there are some state dependencies in this picture. So if I want to think of this picture, I should think of a subspace of the Hilbert space of all CFT states. And that is something that will be important in the story. Okay, so now okay, we have this picture, but somehow, so what kind of statements do we know? Well, for example, now we could ask, once we have written, so again, so we have some like fixed backgrounds, I mean, some background, we have some CFT operators, we have some field operators in the bulk, and we could ask how they are related. Okay, and then there's another entry in this dictionary called the extrapolate dictionary, I guess. So it's sort of, I guess it's part of this prescription. And what it says is, roughly speaking, that if you take one of these bulk field operators, sorry, I guess I should talk about coordinates. So X is my coordinate, say this spherical coordinate here, this coordinate of this S1. And then I also have an additional coordinate, which I call R, which is this radius. Okay, and that's the additional dimension that you gain in this picture when you go from a boundary to the bulk theory. Okay, and so now you could ask, what happens when I take one of these bulk operators all the way to infinity? And so what this dictionary entry sort of tells you is that basically, in quotes, this operator becomes this boundary one, in the sense that when you compute correlation functions computed, using these bulk field operators in the limit of R going to infinity, agree with boundary correlation functions. Okay, so I guess the way this is often written down is as follows: phi of Rx. And now we actually have to rescale it a little bit, so let's not worry about this. This is just some rescaling. So we might write down something like this. Okay. And now you might complain because these are this is an operator on one space, that's an operator on another space. So the way to interpret this indeed is sort of if you plugged it into correlation functions, then there should be limit agreement. Good. And all these subtlety, this will sort of, again, will play a role. So maybe I'll say in the sense of correlation functions. And again, we'll be sort of, when we sort of claim to prove theorems, we'll be more precise in the sense of correlation functions. Okay. Again, in this, some CFT state, it corresponds to such a picture plus a state of these local QFTs. And so this is a sort of a roughly well-defined statement. But now you might ask, so this limit, again, I was saying, is R goes to infinity. So now, of course, you might ask, what's actually the CFT object, the CFT operator corresponding not to this limit, right? So this is a very specialized question, sort of saying, you take an operator all the way out there, and then you know the answer. Then you know what it corresponds to in the CFT. So you might ask, what about this guy? What about, this guy sitting right here in the middle, for example? What does it correspond to? Sort of what's the counter? Yeah, what's the dual object? And maybe this is sort of my working definition of the bulk reconstruction problem. Small piece, but bear with me. So maybe I'll say this is for the purpose of this talk, the bulk reconstruction problem. It's basically what is dual to some, say, phi of Rx. So one specific guy sitting here, right? So somehow we saw that when we take those guys out all the way to infinity, or all the way to the boundary, this bulk operator corresponds to something local, but we would expect if somehow this operator is sitting at a local position in the bulk, then maybe this is actually quite non-local on the boundary. And so it's a question like how to write down formulas, what should these dual objects have to be? And so that's sort of the rough question here. Okay. And now there's some interesting sort of apparent paradoxes if you try to ask this question and you sort of don't worry about these quotes that I wrote and so on. So for example, here's something that seems funny, and this was sort of I learned this certainly from the important paper by Ahmed Chi and Daniel Haller, which is basically the following observation. Well, these field operators, they're supposed to be field operators in some local QFTs to this approximation. So any two field operators will commute. Okay, so in particular, this operator phi of R, for example, sitting at the center, just for fun, right? Will actually commute. Well, it will commute with all of these phi of Rx if R is not equal to zero. So in particular, so as a consequence, also with this boundary operator. Okay, so let me write down a formula, and again in quotes, because course, is not quite something you've proved. So maybe I'll just for simplicity, I'll say, you know, I'll take an operator sitting right here. This is a 0, not an O. This is an O of X, so one of these guys. Well, these O of X's are somewhat limits of phi's, right? Phi's that are very far apart from phi of 0. So shouldn't this be 0? Okay. And now, you know, if you would have written this without quotes and so on, you would be confused because now it seems like this operator sitting at the center commutes with all local field operators on the boundary, which sort of, you know, might imply that it's, you know, proportional to the identity. Okay, so that you might say, okay, isn't this true? Isn't this strange? That would be one objection. I'll also mention another one, which is kind of that there have been actually formulas. Well, you know, you might say, okay, that's quite a problem. Let's ignore this. There have been actually formulas proposed for CFT, non-local CFT operators, that correspond to the spot operator, but actually more than one. And that seems also funny, right? Because somehow, you know, like, is it this CFT operator or is this another one? So this might worry you. There's some kind of redundancy going on. Okay. So I guess this was by a gentleman with initials HKL. So there were provided answers to this problem. Several answers. And again, this might be confusing. So you could say, isn't this a problem? But then, of course, it's not because, well, in hindsight, it's not. Because, you know, these are sort of statements about very special states. So it's not, you know, some of this, it's not the case that these are exact equalities of operators, right? Somehow we said, when I tried sort of to carefully set up this problem, we said that actually, you know, different states even correspond to different geometries. So they're clearly, you know, these are not problems. What did I want to say? Basically, because you know there's things that only work for a subset of states, part of this dictionary of state dependent, if you like. But basically, maybe I'll just in colloquially say, we only work for a subset of states at a time. So these are not operator identities, so this kind of commutativity does not hold on the full CFT Hilbert space, so that's not a problem a priori. Okay.
When you say subset, you don't mean subspace.
I want to be super vague. No. I guess you could probably say subspace.
No, I don't think it's
going to
be
subspace. Oh, it's not even going to. Oh, very good. Excellent.
This is fine.
I mean, when you say it's not going to be a subspace, you mean when you say subspace, you're thinking about the state of CFT states,
yeah.
Or like subsets of CFT states that correspond to some fixed, consistent bulk description.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that if you take two CFT holographic states, you don't want to superpose them.
Even if they correspond to the same classical bulk geometry.
Well, if they correspond to the same classical bulk, yeah.
Sure. Then, I mean, that's what I have in mind, because somehow, you know, I'm thinking, this formula sort of presupposes that we talk about the fixed classical, about the same bulk, right? So in this sense, I guess maybe subspace is fine. Okay. All right, so that's the issue. Okay, so I'll be sort of vague for a little longer. And now I guess we want to sort of sharpen this questions a little bit, using sort of more insight from this paper. And we'll take some clues basically from quantities that we like as conformation theorists, such as entropies. So I want to mention some other entries in this dictionary. So one is, of course, the Ryo-Takanagi formula that we have heard from a couple of times in the conference some weeks ago. I'll draw the same picture. And basically, this asks the question about a quantity. Again, about the quantity that we like, namely, it's basically asking the following question. Suppose you have such, again, we are in the same setup. We have some bulk geometry, some boundary state. And you ask the following question. Suppose you have a subsystem of the boundary A. What is the bulk way of calculating the entropy, the phenomenal entropy, of the reduced density matrix of this boundary state A? Okay, so the question is, what is S of A? And some of the answer that was found by Takayanagi was the following. It is proportional to the length of a minimal surface that is, well, practically speaking, homologous to this boundary if you, let's just say, it has the same endpoints. And you vary about all minimal surfaces because you have this hyperbolic geometry. This minimal surface will look roughly as follows. Okay, so maybe we call this guy gamma of A. And then I think this proportional, and there's some proportionality constant. So gamma of A is the area of a minimal surface homologous to this boundary piece. So this is nice, okay, and maybe that's some leading order answer. So we're happy with one more entry in the dictionary. And now, then there has been a refinement of this formula, though, because right, somehow this formula is agnostic, seemingly, or maybe it's in the dots, but the right-hand side somehow only depends on this geometry, but not actually on the fine-grained state in this bulk. Okay, so you can go a little bit further. You can ask, what's the next correction somewhere in this formula? What is one kind of correction in this formula? I think this was by Faulkner, Lefkowitz, and Magaziner, I think. So they basically said, okay, well, the next term here is the following. You still have this Riotaganagi piece, of course. But then the next term is basically another entropy, and it's an entropy of the state in this bulk. And what subsystem is it an entropy on? Well, it's a subsystem of it's an entropy of the subsystem of this geometric subsystem corresponding to the area sort of subtended enclosed by this minimal surface, which I will in this talk call the entanglement wedge. So let's call this the entanglement wedge. So right, so somehow, what are the states that these quantities are calculated in? Well, this minimal surface is calculated in this bulk geometry. This entropy is calculated in this bulk state. That it is dual to some CFT state, and this entropy is corresponding to the CFT state. Okay.
Yes. Are these typically kind of flat states? I'm asking because in terms of longitude, probably one could ask why is it this entropy measure, not the difference? If they're flat, then probably all entropies are equivalent.
Yeah, so I mean, you can say some things actually. Maybe we can chat more about it later.
These states, so or by flat states, I mean states which are essentially in a. If you look at the eigenvalues, they're all either zero or a constant value. And so, if you now look at different, there are different entropies, Rayleigh entropies, and so on. And if you look at flat states, they're all equivalent. If they're not, then there can be arbitrarily big differences between the entropy. Then one may ask, why is it a particular entropy measure which is relevant, or is the result only true for one or for many?
There is analogous statement for the Rayleigh entropy, which is not flat. So it's not flat.
Okay.
And the Rayleigh entropy is different from the Langevin entropy.
So I guess there's a.
In the ADS,
yeah. So basically, I mean, she has worked on this, right? So there's sort of a, a refined prescription of this, where you minimize something geometric, roughly speaking, right? There's some brains, I guess, for some tension, but. Let me also say that from the CFT world, people know, say, for 1 plus 1 dimensional CFTs, how the Rayleigh entropies look like. And I guess it's there's this 1 plus 1 over n, right, scaling. So I guess it's fair to say, so there's some dependency on n, basically. But still one can...
Yeah. Is only valid for the von Neumann.
So this is this particular suggestion, but there's versions... for example, versions. Well, she has this very nice geometric prescription of, for example, for Rayleigh entropies, and then in the CFT world, there's some simple formulas known and so on. Yeah.
So far, the issue is that quantum field theory, you could have states that are very close in the Hilbert space, but have Rayleigh entropies that are order one different.
Okay. Yes.
Rayleigh is larger than one.
So that's also the details. It's sort of an interesting question to look at, for example, like smooth entropies also in the scenario, particularly when you want to justify certain one-shot results. And this is actually something that also has partially been done by this is a paper by Patrick, Brian Swingle, Hugh Parfus, Nima, Bartek, and I don't know, friends. I guess it's in the appendix of their QRP paper from Sydney from some years ago. So there's also some thoughts on smooth entropies, and I've also been thinking a bit
more. Not the reason why I was asking is that for flat states, these expressions we have on the left for the recovery, we know much more about them, for example, about tightness and their inequalities and so on, rather than inequalities. So if flat states were an interesting subclass of states for in this scenario, one could probably use stronger statements than that one.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether they are actually.
I mean, I'm making the inequality.
I mean, you have equality. You know, for example, this question that you asked already, it's then equal to the relative entropy. You have answers in the case where there are flat states. So we know more about it. It's not necessarily tight. I mean, okay, this is almost tight. So it's
but how about like almost flat things? Is that also like sort of easy?
Depends on how you define almost.
Say
it is moving.
Yes. Okay.
If you define it as what? Sorry.
If you define almost flat in terms of like, I mean, there are these move entropies which are defined and by looking at entropies of very close states, very close means you look at essentially, let's say, the trace distance. So in this sense, if they are in trace distance close to a flat state, then the statements there that I just mentioned would remain true approximately up to this epsilon that comes from the trace.
There are monocular theories with flat spectrum, topological.
I see.
Okay. There could be special cases.
Yes.
Well, there may be reasons to think that flat spectra play some role in the ADS story as well, just not the obvious one.
Okay. I think somehow, the first paper that I know that sort of really sort of in some sense, you know, spoke about sort of quantum information tasks with operational meaning and took this distinction seriously, I think was your paper basically, where you, if I recall correctly, you sort of, it was about rates, right, and then you have to relate somehow, say, some smooth entropy to the actual phenomenon entropy as predicted, for example, by this formula. Maybe, you knew it in these CFT states, in this 1 plus 1 dimensional states. So somehow, that is a good point. But actually, the point I wanted to make here is that now we have some interesting relation, right, because let's imagine this to be some fixed quantity. This is a quantity that only depends on the bulk state restricted to this entanglement wedge. This is a quantity that only depends on the reduced density matrix of this boundary. And so sort of it suggests now that, right, you know, maybe actually in this duality, things inside this entanglement wedge correspond to things that are localized within this region A. And it's sort of consistent, I guess, with this, you know, when you take the limit all the way to infinity, right, because you could say this region can become smaller and smaller and smaller until you hug the single point. So that's sort of, I guess, consistent expression. So somehow this raises the question, which I guess, of course, many of you have seen, many of you have worked on this, whether this dictionary can be extended to saying that, you know, objects, maybe operators that are supported in this entanglement wedge have an equivalent expression in terms of operators localized on the corresponding boundary subsystem. Just because from the sort of sensitivity of entropy, say, okay. And then this has been sharpened somehow, this formula, in the following sense, or a sort of seemingly stronger formula has been proved, relating not just entropies, but actually relative entropies. So now the setup is the following. We look at two CFT states, say, maybe they're close together, they have the same, let me not say close together, maybe they have the same bulk geometry, or the same classical bulk geometry, roughly speaking. And then we could ask the following question. We could try to relate the relative entropy between rho A and sigma A with the relative entropy, so A are these boundary subsystems, rho and sigma are two states. And we could look at the corresponding relative entropy when we restrict these bulk states to the entanglement wedge. Okay. And so then it has proposed there that actually these two relative entropies are equal. Okay, and that's a seemingly a much stronger statement. Somehow it really says that it really makes very plausible that objects in this entanglement wedge are related to objects on the corresponding boundary subsystem. Okay, so, and then naturally led to say this entanglement coming with the EW entanglement wedge. You could say the entanglement wedge reconstruction problem or hypothesis or conjecture at the time was basically exactly what I said. It was basically the following statement, that for all operators, I'll just sort of loosely write, for all sort of field operators located within this entanglement wedge, there should exist some corresponding boundary operator living on this boundary subsystem, such that, you know, this, again, in quotes, in the sense of, say, correlation functions, okay. So that is sort of the proposal, and then, well, this was sort of, yeah.
Sorry, let me slow down a little bit and ask the obvious question,
yes.
Just to see how you're thinking about this. So if you, I mean, you might have said that, I mean, there's a whole subspace or subset of CFD states that have the same geometry. So from the, you might have said that the right-hand side of that relative entropy was zero because the geometry is the same, but of course they're different CFD states. So you would have said that the left-hand side is definitely non-zero. So how do you, I mean, how are you thinking about the resolution?
How are you thinking about it? So what's
the right-hand side is also not zero for two bulk states, two different bulk states in the same geometry.
Right.
So I don't see a problem.
I mean, this would be the bulk, of the bulk quantum field. Not,
right.
Yeah.
Bulk quantum fields would have some relative entropy. If you have a scalar field in different state, but in the same background, so both sides would be order one in a large n expansion.
Okay, so you would say that every difference that you could do in the CFD state is detectable, not from the geometry, but from the state of the fields.
That's what this is saying.
Yeah, that's
in fact what needs to be true in order for bulk reconstruction to work.
One thing I'm confused about here is that, so is it necessary in this story for sigma A to be a particular solution with no quantum excitations on top of it? Can I take rho A and sigma A to be not vacuum ADS? Both of them have some excitations on top of vacuum state.
As long as they are semi-classically close to each other, that's okay.
What does that mean? I guess my question is, what does it mean for the two states to be semi-classically close to each other?
The quantum corrective metric in the bulk are close to the same to leading order in one brand. That means you can have excited field states in, for example, some matter field in the bulk, and that only back react to high order in one of n expansion. So at leading order, you don't see any difference in the metric.
So if you take this in this approximation you're talking about in the bulk, can you conclude that can you find examples where this rho A sigma A in the bulk is asymmetric as well, or is it always going to end up being symmetric?
It can be asymmetric, for sure.
It can be asymmetric.
Surely be asymmetric. You're asking whether I can find situations where d rho sigma is different from d sigma rho, right?
In this approximation, for these states.
I believe so, surely, yes, because in the bulk you can certainly have two quantum field theory states that are asymmetric. You can create two states in the bulk of some matter field that has d rho sigma is different from sigma rho, and then this formula tells you that the same thing must happen on the boundary.
I'm a little bit nervous because of the fact that if you look at relative entropy of two states that are both coherent states, that relative entropy has further properties.
Yeah, but coherent states are very special. Here we're talking about the general state in the bulk, at least. We can be talking about a very general state for matter fields in the bulk.
Okay, so that's all. So we can take both rho and sigma to be non-coherent states.
Non-coherent state in the bulk.
Okay.
You can also take them to be coherent state, but that's a special case.
Very good. Let me maybe draw one more picture and then make a claim, and then we sort of write on Hilbert spaces and isometries, and we'll feel happy. So I guess in some sense you could say, okay, this is sort of a refinement, you know, of sort of what I claimed before, that there's, you know, multiple answers, right? Because now actually sort of this sort of precisely tells you, know, what are the sort of the possible points in the bulk and the corresponding, you know, subsets of the boundary where you could hope to recover some operators. Okay, when they say recover, I mean, for example, something like this, they find a dual operator. And so there was this beautiful picture again in the paper by Xi and friends, which is basically as follows. So suppose you have, again, our favorite picture. We have three subsystems now, A, B, and C. And if you look at a joint subsystem of two of these boundaries, for example, A and B, then the corresponding minimal surface will look like this, right? So this is the minimal surface because of the minimal surface for C. Likewise, this is gamma AB. Now this guy is gamma BC, and this one is gamma AC. Okay, and you will see because I mean they all of them enclose in particular, for example, a point over here. Okay, so maybe I'll call this guy phi. So now, if this story were correct, right? I mean, given this hypothesis, it should be possible to find three kinds of operators, right? It should be possible to find an operator OA, because it's within this entangled, enclosed by the real Takenaga surface for AB, there should be an operator on AB. There should also be one on AC, and there should also be one on BC. So in some sense, we have something like this. Again, these are not equals operators, so that's not really a paradox. But there would be a paradox, right, if we really thought of this as like states on the CFT, because this is a local operator on a subsystem AB, on AC and BC. And, you know, if these were really like full operators supported on, say, two out of three tensor factors, then it would mean that O is proportional to the identity. So this is sort of, you know, what sort of, I think, prompted, I mean, this is part of like something that makes this not non-problem, more concrete, okay. But now, okay, we put this in quotes and we are happy, right, because we say it only applies maybe for certain states, and so they don't actually have to be the same operators and so on. But now it's actually nice, right, because basically what this says is that we have some kind of redundancy, right? We can interpret this in a different way. We can say that we have this, you know, basically we have a state on the bulk. If you look at the corresponding state in the boundary, we can think of this as some kind of encoding, right? This is like a different representation of the state, and this representation of the state has the property that if you lose subsystem C, you can still recover the quantum information corresponding to this operator from AB, likewise from AC and from BC. So this is a property. This is a feature of error correction. It's sort of part of what we think of an erasure code, right? We can erase either of these boundaries, yet we can reconstruct the quantum information of, say, corresponding to operator sitting at phi. So we can say this is the erasure code. And this was sort of this beautiful observation in this paper, well, part of the beautiful observation in this paper that prompted all this this business. Yes?
So, and so far, there is no statement about, say, something does spoil C on the boundary.
Yes.
There is no statement about being able to reinstate that boundary state from the AB information.
That's right. In this, that's correct. I guess one could. That's correct. Yeah. So here I will write down sort of a formal definition. Actually, what I mean by this, equivalence that I put in quotes in a second. In some sense, there's two different options. I think there's sort of a strong kind and a weak kind. One way of interpreting this is sort of that it shouldn't make a difference. You know, suppose you take a state in the bulk. You take the state in the bulk, you act by this operator phi, and then you look at the dual CFT state. This should have the same effect as looking at the dual CFT state and then acting by this operator. So actually, in this sense, right, like somehow you got the full state, right? But because you do a state transformation, it's not. I didn't erase the boundary, right? I'm saying I can implement an operator sitting here equivalently by an operator say on AB. I'll be more precise, but so that's also a way of thinking about it. Good. And then it was shown that actually this relative entropy condition, if we take it to be an equality, say, it actually implies n-fang reconstruction. Sorry, this is not well. want to say something different. I want to say that Sheed and Aldo and Aaron Wall showed that, well, this relative entropy condition, maybe I'll just say GLMS for it, implies entanglement wedge reconstruction. And somehow, assuming, say, this is really an equality of relative entropies. Okay, and you might ask, you know, we have all this beautiful machinery now for dealing with approximate equality of relative entropies. Surely they can be used to, you know, to give sort of a proof that that works even when there's some, you know, 1 over n fluctuations, yeah, some little epsilons. Okay, but that's what I want to talk about next in a toy scenario sort of this problem. Yes.
One naive question is that, so that phi that you're inserting in the middle, that's not a gauge invariant operator, right? So you have to dress it and attach it all, take it all the way to the beginning, right?
Okay.
So how does this argument change? I suppose you could make this rigorous, but...
Maybe we'll ask the experts what the answer is.
In fact, there are inequivalent ways of dressing it. Right, you could add various different gravitational dressings to that to make it gauge invariant,
sure.
Say working perturbatively in G nu.
Sure.
So now you might associate somehow those dressings with the different patches. That's one way of doing it. And, you know, whether that connects to this story, I think it's...
I suppose this argument could be made rigorous by just somehow attaching these dressings, but I just don't see how to do it. Because, like, you're using the fact that A and B and C cover the whole space, so where are you sticking that? How does it reach infinity?
I mean, I guess you could choose a different way for each of these operators.
So one thing you can do is you choose a particular gravitational dressing. Let's say you dress it to a particular point on the boundary, and you fix that. That's a particular operator you'd like to consider.
Sure.
And then you can choose your A, B, and C strategically so that in here, you, if you really took that three operator being equal as an operator equation, you would conclude that operator is the identity. In the case of gravitational dressing, if you really think of the different you can still have different realizations. You just need to make sure the entanglement wedge contains all the gravitational dressing as well as the operator that you are looking at. And then you would conclude a paradox if you took reconstruction as an operator equation,
yeah.
You would conclude a statement that the operator you are looking at is actually a local operator on the boundary. Instead of concluding it's an identity operator, you conclude something equally bizarre.
Sure. So you would say that the literal operator statement of this would not work.
Right.
But you want to make sense of that as an approximate statement. Where and how would you do that? Like, you still want to make a statement about the Hilbert space, which is like sense, right?
But I would then say, because the operators are clearly not the same because of this argument, what we mean when we say the same thing can be represented in different ways is that they work in some code subspace. So that's the statement. That statement is still true with a gravitational dressing. So I first argue that they're not the same operator, because if they are, that would have to be a local operator in the CFT. That's impossible. And then I retreat from that impossible situation by declaring the equality of the operators only work on a subspace.
I agree that this could be made precise. I don't know how. Okay.
May I suggest?
There is a more precise version of this that show. I mean, you can show order by order perturbation theory how to do the entanglement reconstruction based on here we're only talking about one loop. So for example, the FLM result and GLMS result is only to one loop, but one can potentially improve it to higher orders.
It's not an issue of loops, right? It's just a statement about
postpone this so that I can make my quantum information friends happy. Sorry. Well, I guess this is supposed to be discussion, but I want to sort of at least sort of sketch some, I guess make this connection back to recovery maps for brief, if that's all right. So for this, like, maybe let me first actually give you some toy setup. that sort of seeks to model the situation. I'll not give you the most general one, but one that sort of uses subsets, you know, tensor products and sort of nice subsets, and maybe also give you some examples, reinforcing what we said here. And so the example, the situation I want to consider is the following. Here we made the statement that, you know, we should not think about all CFT, the full CFT Hilbert space at once, so we should focus on a set, on a subspace, in my opinion, of states that correspond, say, to a fixed classical geometry and a bunch of states on this background. And so this I will model by something I call the code subspace, the code some Hilbert space, H code, which plays the role of sort of, you know, the state on which all these things are actually true without equality signs. So the model is there's some H code. Then there's also the CFT Hilbert space. This is supposed to be a subspace. I just want to be explicit about this. So what I want to say is that there's some isometry relating these two Hilbert spaces. Okay. So now suppose we are in the situation that we have chosen some boundary subsystem A, and then there is a corresponding entanglement wedge little a. And the way I want to model this, and again, it's not the most general situation, is that I want to say that, well, this means that I can, you know, I'm given some factorization of this code subspace into HA and HA bar, corresponding to this entanglement wedge and its complement. And I'm also given a factorization of the CFT Hilbert space. Again, it's a tensor product. Of course, these are not tensor products in reality. So maybe we'll later talk a bit about algebra, so maybe we'll not.
Is that supposed to be one-to-one, or does that have a kernel?
Excuse me?
Is that supposed to be one-to-one, or does that have a kernel?
I want to say it's one-to-one for this discussion. Yes. Yeah. Sort of ignoring this discussion. Right.
Are you asking about the first line or the second?
Yeah, the first line.
Firstly, the isometry, yeah.
The isometry.
I mean, if you think about them as CFT states, I think it would be legitimate, right? As a subspace of CFT states.
Yeah, but
maybe
you can get any state in the CFT by using this map, right?
No, I mean, isometry just means it's an embedding, it's a subspace, it maps into a subspace one-to-one.
So I would say it's not onto one.
It's not onto one.
It's one-to-one.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a technical.
Isometry means, indeed, like preserves angles, it preserves norms, yeah.
It's not,
yeah. Okay. That's what I'm saying. So now in this scenario, right? Now we try to sort of, for example, let's ask, you know, okay. So maybe just some notation. Suppose we are given some density operator rho on this code subspace. So I'll use this notation rho or rho subcode. Then we can associate with it now two density matrices. One is the density matrix where I just trace out, you know, this A hat factor. And the other is the density matrix where I first map the state onto this, you know, CFT space. So what I do is I apply this isometry, I encode it, and then I trace out the A bar system, the complement of A. Okay, so these are two states I can naturally associate with any global state on H code. Okay, so that's the notation I want to use. And now we can ask, you know, what's a good way of formalizing this statement? How to formalize, you know, this entanglement reconstruction condition? Let's formalize. Well, I'll give you two options. So maybe we could say, okay, what we want is that for all operators phi of little a, acting on h of little a, there should exist some couple OA. And well, now I have to give you a condition. Clearly, this does not make sense anymore, because they act in two different spaces. And so maybe I'll give you one version. Maybe I'll call strong recovery. And what it says is that, indeed, what I said in words before. So suppose I first act by phi sub a, so this is an operator on this factor. So, you know, I should formally tensor with the identity on a bar. Now, this is an operator on h code. I can apply this isometry, or I could say, well, let's first apply the isometry, and then let's act with capital OA. Okay. Okay. So that is one good option. And short, we'll abbreviate this always as follows. We'll always only tensors with the identity. So now there's another kind that I will call weak, which is the following, which says that phi sub a is equal to b dagger OAV. So this means if I take this boundary operator, this local boundary operator, and I restrict it to the code subspace, then I get this bulk operator back, this logical operator back. So in language quantum error correction, this is a logical, well, it's an operator on the code. It's implementation, so I guess this we actually call logical operator usually. Or this implements a logical operator. So this would be another way to say it again. And so why do I call this strong and weak? Because V is an isometry, so if I apply V dagger from the left to this equation, I get this one. Okay, so this implies this guy. From here, it is not clear that OA preserves the code subspace, right? Because I have to restrict it first. But that's, for example, a difference, I suppose. So
can you explain the physical difference between
Indeed. So if you have this condition, then you can compute, for example, one-point functions or expectation values of a single operator, right? So let me actually write this down. suppose I want to compute something like suppose I compute this expectation value of OA on the encoded state, okay, using our notation, this is just the same as just writing row, right, because we omit the identities always. So now this, let me, row A. So row A is the reduced density matrix of B row V dagger. Okay, so this is trace of OA V row V dagger, where row is the state on the code. Okay, so now I can use the cluster of the trace, move this over there, and I get V dagger OA B row. Maybe just to be sure, let me write row code here. I mean, row is always row code, but here in particular it is. And so now, if I have this, what I call the weaker version of this condition, then this is still phi A. So I can compute this expectation value like this.
What does strong give you this?
Exactly. So this is true, right? This is true for a local operator. It's true for products if this conjecture holds. So there's no problem. You can calculate everything, if you like. But what is not so obvious is the following. Suppose you do something like OA1, OA2 of row, right? OA. Then the question is like, is this the same as phi A1, phi A2? In the code, in the original state, row A, if you like. So that is something that seems desirable, right? It seems desirable that you can sort of first you can take two local bulk operators, map them to independently using two boundary operators, and then if you multiply those, I suppose you would like to compute the two-point function of the bulk in this way. So think of these as something that is, both of these as maybe some phi of R axis at different points, but both within the entanglement wedge. And this is kind of saying, this is sort of saying for all sort of composite questions that you will ask later, for all endpoint functions, you can basically map out the individual operators. I think if you have exact reconstruction, then actually somehow it is equivalent. You can always find OAs that, for example, weak implies strong. We'll discuss about this possibly. But in the approximate case, that's an interesting question, and I'll sort of ask it more explicitly later. So that's what I want to say. And in some sense, what this recovery map theory gives you very easily is this kind of reconstruction. Okay. Because somehow you sort of always ask questions about encoded states. So the kind of objects you look at are always code states. So you never worry about these sort of other matrix elements. Okay. So maybe to summarize, this is what I said here. So this easily implies that you can do endpoint functions. And right, somehow the proof goes as you write this as V dagger rho V, and then you can sort of pull through these V daggers. So it's just like V dagger rho V. And then right, I can use that. I guess V dagger is the encoding. I can write. I can sort of move the V here. I get phi. I can move it back through again. So this way, I can compute arbitrary composite or expectation values. Okay.
Particularly, if you just had the V but not the strong reconstruction, you wouldn't be able to use the sort of arguments dealing with sort of bulk commutators, phi, sort of recovering the different operators in different regions and things like that.
Yeah, that is another consequence. That's right. Yeah, like if you even like suppose you want to relate different choice of A with each other somehow. Yes. I mean, yeah.
So,
An equivalent statement would be that without the strong condition, you won't see the boundary OPE consistent with the bulk OPE, because you should start taking operator products and making deposits. You're not guaranteed that you'll get.
I think I agree, that's right. Because
roughly, you can have intermediate states that are out of the code subspace, or resolution of the code.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's somehow what you can't avoid if you just knew this. But somehow, what we know though is somehow in this exact case, somehow when some of this is possible for all operators, in the weak sense is also possible in the strong sense. Okay.
Is that supposed to be a precise statement? If this is true exactly, that you can derive the strong case.
In the sense that, well, there exists some choice of OA for which the strong one is true. You know, you might give possibly, maybe that's the statement I would like to make. So for example, even if you use the PETS recovery map in the exact case, but we'll talk about in a second, to define these boundary operators, it would have this property. It would even sort of preserve the algebra in a sense. Somehow, it would be true that if you map out a product, it's equal to the product of the mapped out operators.
If you use the PETS map.
In this exact case. And I think also what you guys do probably, I mean, I'm sure has this property. It's sort of an interesting point. Maybe let me write down actually how these recovery maps enter, and then we can sort of see why it's maybe not obvious. Yeah.
If I add the condition that a weak statement is true both for A and A complement, that gives more information.
Approximately true, you mean?
Yeah, let's say in the approximate case, because in the precise case it seems that the statement just goes back.
I'm not 100% sure, to be honest. It's not clear to me in a black box fashion, in the sense that if there were an approximate recovery map, would it lead to a prescription for calculating boundary operators? That has this multiplicative property, this sort of algebra filling property. That's one of the open questions I would like to share.
What we can get about this statement. So in the Hagman with reconstruction, you're talking about for all phi A bulk, there exist operators on the boundary. Now, but if you're saying that you can calculate two-point functions of boundary operators using the bulk calculation, that seems too strong.
The other way around. I'm saying sort of, suppose you have some, I don't know, phi of x, phi of y and phi of y prime in the bulk. Then I could individually map them out and I get some, I don't know, O1 and O2 in the boundary. And now I can, I know that somehow multiplying these O's will have the same effect as multiplying the phi's and then mapping them out, right? Like some of this is different, right? You could also like look at the product, which you could call this phi A, and you would get some corresponding OA. And now the question is basically, I know that this operator calculates a two-point function of the bulk. The question is like, does the product of these operators calculate a two-point function in the bulk?
Yeah, that's very strong. Okay.
But this, I think it's what you would need for example for relating OPEs or something like this. I mean that seems. I guess you want to have a dictionary, but that would allow you this. Yeah. So yeah, it is indeed strong. Good. So this is what. Okay. So I guess there's like a third version of this that you could ask, but it's maybe the even stronger version, right? Where you somehow, I guess. Let me write it down and then put it in quotes. I guess how does it go? Also ask that, you know, maybe this is true. Okay. Why is this the strongest? Because if I write multiply from with V, I get this one. But this one is somehow too strong, right? Because it actually gives a formula for the boundary operator. And now if you apply this to different A's, right, in the same way, for example, in this scenario, you would actually get, this operator only depends on the specific point you chose. Say this is some 5-0. But I apply now this notion for AB, for AC, and for BC. So left-hand side is always the same. So I would actually get the conclusion that these operators should be equal. So that's not that's too strong of a notion. So we'll not.
And the left-hand side doesn't know about A. That's what you're saying.
That's right. I'm not about the boundary A. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's indeed, because you know this is just some phi that such that it's contained in the time range. So that's not no good. Okay. So having sort of clarified this, let's talk about some examples. Okay. So here's, so how would you construct such, you know, such situations? Maybe for a fixed, right, so for fixed factorizations. So here's a way. Suppose this is A. This is A bar. Okay. Good. So this, our unitary V is a tensor product of two unitaries. One acts from little a to capital A. One acts from little a bar to capital A bar. Okay. That's not so interesting. Here's a slightly more interesting example. Suppose we take some pure state chi. We feed half in it into this left unitary isometry, half in the right isometry. This whole box is now what I call V, right? So the box that contains this. This is V. Now it is still sort of almost pictorially true, like clear that you can recover the information little a, right? Because you can just undo, you can apply W dagger on A, and you forget about the system. Maybe I call the system E, and this one E bar. Does this construction make sense? So I have two inputs, A and A bar, they together make up this code subspace. I add an additional pure state to this. I act on AE as well as an A bar, E bar with two different isometries, mapping me into, say, capital A and capital A bar. So that's a good construction. For example, you can choose OA equals, well, you take your favorite bulk operator. You act with this with the identity on E, and you apply, I guess. Unless the daggers are wrong. No, the daggers are. Sure. This is right, no?
Yeah, I think this is right.
So this is one possible choice, and you can sort of, right? If you apply now OA and after V, W dagger cancels with W. Phi A sits here, but then you have a W again, so clearly the strong condition is satisfied. Okay. And it is a theorem that, in fact, if you have this, for example, if you have this reconstruction condition both for A and A complement, then actually any isometry satisfying this reconstruction, these two complementary reconstruction properties has this form. So in some sense, this is a generic example, okay. I mean, we don't know this yet. Maybe we'll never know, but that's right. But that's sort of a good thing to have in mind, right? So somehow, you know, I guess you can sort of maybe imagine that somehow there's a set of entanglement here, and that then somehow this, you know. Anyways, yeah, that's all I want to say.
So in this picture, yes. What would E be?
What would E be? I mean, from this confirmation perspective, it's just an additional way to adding noise, but it's a kind of noise that's not relevant for the decoding. Because some of this isometry sort of, if you undo the isometry, cleanly separates the noise. So it's, yeah. But what it will lead to entanglement between A and A complement. So for example, if you suppose you input some state here, some pure state, for example, and then you compute the entanglement entropy of A, well, somehow this isometry doesn't matter, so you can throw it away, but then A bar is decorrelated from the left-hand side. So what you'll find is actually that S of A equals the entanglement contributed by this fixed state, S of, so this is, sorry, let me just be precise, this is this encoded state, V rho V dagger, this is this chi state, which is a fixed state, right, this is fixed, plus the entropy of the subs, of rho A. But this is a constant. This is a constant in the same way that in this version of the Riotaganari formula, we take this to be a constant.
Okay.
So this is somehow. I think this was probably first in Daniel's paper. I think. So this is a constant, right? That's called S zero. And so now, okay, so there's sort of this beautiful relation, right? You sort of have this dual reconstruction property. It implies the structure, which in turn implies this Riotaganagi form. It also implies this Riotaganagi-like formula for the complements in this situation, right? And the Riotaganagi form in turn actually implies this relative entropy properties. And we'll see also, it's also true that the relative entropy properties imply this reconstruction property in the strong sense. So somehow all these things actually are equivalent on sort of for example in this situation or in this algebraic version. And it's like generality. Okay. So that's okay, we'll very good. I guess I wanted to give you some other examples? Yeah, maybe I'll give you one more example, and then we'll talk actually about recovery maps in this context. So let me maybe just say this is actually a normal form. So let's say any V is of this form. Any V is of this form if we have entanglement wedge reconstruction for A as well as for A complement.
Good. In the holographic context, does the presence of P mean that you need something other outside of the CFD, some external coupling to some other field?
No, I don't. I mean, it's not. At least no. I don't think. I mean, it does not have to be. There does have to be such an E, but I think of I think of it as giving contributions to the Sturm-Thurgenagy term, basically. It's like a bulk thing, right?
The area term.
Yes.
The difference within microstates of black holes. So
when you say if you have entanglement wedge reconstruction for a complementary region, do you mean a strong version?
The strong version, yeah, that's right. Yes. But then in this exact case, somehow I think weak will also imply strong. Because weak is somehow good enough for recovery maps. Recovery maps imply that the relative entropies are the same.
Well,
then you that would be in a roundabout way. Yeah.
Well, when you say exact, what do you mean by exact?
I mean, really, that this is an equality, for example. This is an equality.
But we don't believe that in holography.
Very good. So that's great. We'll talk about approximate case now. So in the approximate case, I think that's an interesting question, basically, how are these notions related? Which I guess we haven't thought about for too long, but if we it seemed interesting. One can sort of, maybe another point I should make, so one can sort of... Let me talk about recovery maps, and then I think I can better like sort of point out explain these points. One other question. So we spoke about erasure codes here. Clearly, erasure codes are another example of this framework. Arguably, this one is maybe not so interesting, right? Because this factorization depends on your choice of A and A complement. And really, somehow, the entire point is that you can vary A, and you have many codes at once, and they're somehow still compatible. And an erasure code is something in particular that gives you something like this, right? It's sort of, you can think of something like a 1-3 Q-grid code by Richard Cleaved and Gottesman and Heukwang Lo, for example, where you sort of encode one Q-grid into three Q-grids. Maybe you call this 1-2-3. This is the code. So here the code does not actually factorize. We just have a single site in the bulk, just like in this example. And then erasure codes is the property that you, if you, for example, and a 2-3 erasure code is a property that if you have two of those guys, you can still reconstruct the information. But you can choose any two. So you can, it's saying you can vary A, okay? And you can verify that if you write down a concrete code, you can always, for any given choice of A and A bar, you can write down such a normal form. You can see that it actually works. Okay. So now let me, and so one way of producing, erasure codes is using perfect tensors. They are a stronger notion of an erasure code. Perfect tensors are tensors that are unitaries in all directions. So this implies this erasure property. And then you can take perfect tensors, you can combine them into tensor networks. And then, into certain circumstances, for certain A's, there still exists such an erasure property. Or you can take random tensors, you can do the same. So this is kind of how this connects to these toy models. So in these toy models, this entanglement reconstruction property had also been verified. Depending on the toy model, for you have to put constraints on your A's, or your regions A for which this is true, or on your graphs, on your geometries, and so on. So let me this connects to perfect tensors and to tensor network models. But we want to talk about recovery maps now. So let me just sort of tell you what's the twist, what's the little twist. And so what we'd like to show is that suppose these relative entropies are approximately the same, rho A sigma A, rho A sigma A, we'd like to show that, say at least, you know, this weak notion of recovery is true. And actually we can do a bit more. We can actually show that even though, you know, naively you would think you can only reproduce one-point functions, actually two-point functions work also. This follows from some the Schwarz inequality for quantum channels and so on. But just to, so actually you can do this OPE games. Well, I guess, well, So here it's like it's very, very general. It says like for each phi A there exists an OA. You might demand that these operators OA are produced, you know, in a systematic fashion from the phis. For example, by applying some quantum channel or the adjoint of a quantum channel, like in the quantum channel Heisenberg picture. If you have something like this, then actually you can show that somehow even the two-point functions are calculated approximately correct. That's just sort of a comment to tie in here. I will not give you the reason why this is the case, but just to show that actually the weak kinds are already pretty interesting. Okay, so then we'd like to show that this is true. Well, and it seems sort of to quite obviously follow from the theorem that Omar mentioned, except that it does not quite, because this is a statement about. So let's assume just for simplicity that this is true for all row codes and. Let's say for all sigma codes, but or in particular for something like a maximic state, okay? Say, and sigma code. Let's say for some sigma code such that these quantities are finite, right? Something like that, that's full rank, for example, just to make our life simple. I'll not write down sigma, but I want this to be true for all codes. So now I could take this universal recovery map, which only depends on sigma, and which should allow us to recover the quantum information and so on and so forth. But the point is, of course, that, right, somehow it is not clear that this, so this is a subsystem of the boundary disk, but this is a subsystem of the bulk, and there's no quantum channel that goes from the entanglement wedge to the corresponding boundary subsystem, right? If we had such a channel somehow, we would have in some sense proved that, you know, this equivalence. So somehow the problem is that this is not obviously in this framework, right, because row A is trace over A bar, B row code. So this is not obviously of the form E of row A. Because, there's no row. Row code is not a tensor product or something, right? So that's like a mild obstacle to sort of directly applying the theory. Okay, because I really need that somehow these two states are related by some CP map. In particular, there's no monotonicity in an obvious way a priori, right? It could be that this is larger, or it could be that this is smaller on the right-hand side. I mean, right? If there's no channel, like why should the relative entropies be somehow sensitive? It should be monotonic. So a priori, there's no sign here actually. Like, you know, if you just had this setup. So a priori there's no channel, there's a little trick. And the idea is basically, well, for special code states, actually, there is a channel. For example, you could take code states that are of the form some row A tensor, you know, some reference state on A bar. So basically, in the language of holography, this would be kind of, well, states that are a tensor product between the entanglement match and the rest. They're sort of uncorrelated. But you know, I mean, sort of on the level of these, the state of these fields.
Yes.
I said this just such that these quantities would not be infinite. So I would like to apply this to a state that is such that the reduced density matrix are full rank.
Right hand side is always full rank, right? These are states of the quantum field theory, so they're always full rank. Sigma little a, right? So rho a little a, sigma little a, but that's not sufficient or something.
Okay, I mean, if I get this promise, then I would also know the left-hand side is finite, and I would be happy, right?
They're both quantum field theory states, so it will be full-rank.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe an example like where it's not so obvious, if you look at this one of these tensor network models, right, then what corresponds to the state of the bulk is basically what the state you feed into all these legs. And people would always say something like, you know, a tensor product state corresponds somewhat to something like the ground state on the boundary, because the only correlations introduced somewhat, they come from the geometry. And oftentimes people think in these tensor networks models that you insert a product state here, sort of, you know, because this actually gets you this holographic state as opposed to code. And then they, you know, you get some boundary state. But in this case, this has not full rank, for example, right? But something like, you know, something with, I mean, you can perturb it slightly, or you could use the argument you said somehow. You say that, okay, I think, you know, these states are not orthogonal, for example, on these states are not orthogonal on the reduced level, so also this will be finite. Let's say we chose some nice reference state, and So for my purposes, okay, because we maybe lost some physics from this to this column, let me just say I choose sigma to be a maximum mixed state on the code subspace, which I could do. So sigma is a reference state, maximum mixed. So sigma code is again a global state, a sigma code on H code.
You don't have to answer this. Maybe we can come back to this. Are you going to use the fact that it's maximum? I will.
I think I will use that it factorizes. I think this I will use.
Okay.
For sort of at least this discussion. And yes. So the kind of reduction. So the idea that I want to say is, well, there's these special code states which factorize, okay. So let's look at the following. Let's look at rho tilde of A equals trace over A bar. And now we look at the following state, rho restricted entanglement. Tensor, again, maybe we choose, you know, the sigma A bar state. So that's some of the other sprite. This is like the complement, the reduced state of this reference state. Just something fixed, something that does not depend on rho. Okay, so now this has the form E of rho A, right? So this is a channel from rho A to the boundary. Okay, so I can apply this recovery theory to it, and what will it tell me? Well, it's going to tell me that. So let me skip this A star. So star is, well, I guess this one is really a star. Sorry. So star is going to imply that there exists some R, some universal R. This R will only depend, again, on this reference state I choose. I choose it to be sigma A in this case, sigma restricted to little a. So I'll just write there exists an R such that R of, well, this rho A tilde, right? Some of the wrong boundary state. So the boundary state that I would have gotten by factorizing, this, by sort of by hand factorizing the bulk state, is close to the initial state, okay. Right, because I have a channel. Because these are just special code states, right? So still, this assumption is very valid, right? So I can think of this as a this is rho tilde of code. Rho tilde of code has the same reduced density matrix on A, but now the output state is rho A tilde. Okay. So I can still use this relative entropy assumption because I'm just applying it to very special states. Okay. Now, because I choose sigma to be a tensor product, actually for sigma it doesn't make a difference. Sigma tilde is equal to sigma. That's the one trick I'll use here. So what it tells me is, right, I can recover somehow in the state sense, not in the operator sense. We'll talk about the operator in a second. In the state sense, from knowing the reduced density matrix on capital A of this modified state, I can recover the original information. Okay, that is true. But now, the question is, well, okay, this is the wrong state. That I recover. I would really like to recover rho A. But now I can actually use this assumption again. Because both rho code and rho tilde of code, they have the same reduced density matrix in A. Sort of by construction, right? So I can sort of but what this statement tells me is that, you know, if I have the same reduced density matrix in the entanglement wedge, then the boundary states actually have to be close. Okay. So sort of a posteriori, sort of, or using this assumption twice, I find that actually, well, rho A tilde is actually close to rho A, again, by our assumption. So somehow we use this relative entropy assumption twice, once to apply recovery theory and then to the wrong channel, and then to say that actually using the wrong channel or using this local channel is actually fine. Okay. So in some sense, like, if you believe that this is true, then actually shouldn't matter if I put in one of these factorized states. If I just look at the corresponding reduced density matrix. Is that happy, right? Like if I, Good. So if I combine this, then I will find that indeed R of rho A is close to rho of little a. And crucially, this holds for all rho code, right? So this is a statement about entangled states. It can be entangled states, but I apply this to reduced density matrix, I get this back. So this is not presupposing that there exists some local channel for these general states. Okay. Yes?
Maybe I didn't fully understand the second part. So can you explain again how you got this rho A tilde? Is
it So my assumption is that I was sloppy. Actually, here I use this assumption. For example, yes. So suppose you knew that this relative and these relative entropies are preserved approximately for all rho and sigma, say. I guess I can restrict it a little bit, but let's suppose this is true. You know, when one is infinite, the other is infinite, say. Otherwise, the epsilon close. Then if I know that the reduced density matrices of rho and sigma on this entanglement wedge, sort of on this input factor, are the same, then they will be close. Then these reduced density matrices will have a small relative entropy in the output.
And you just use them.
And then again, I do Pinsker, indeed, yeah. So that is, of course, something that seems strong that we use in the proof, but sort of, yeah. Yes?
You mentioned you wanted to assume sigma is a mixed state or at least a product state for simplicity, but even if it's not a product state, shouldn't you be able to run the same approximate argument using the relative entropy for sigma A tilde, even though it's not equal to sigma A, it's still close according to the relative entropy statement?
I think, let me just one sec. For some reason I thought when I apply this construction to sigma, I actually want to get sigma back.
Exactly?
No. I thought that I want to get it exactly back, so that actually such that this is a special case of this assumption for this particular choice of sigma code. Maybe you're right. I'm not exactly sure now. But I guess somehow what I said here somehow seemed like maybe something that might worry you a bit more in a sense, right? So I was really comparing. I was using this relative entropy assumption to compare. Sort of, I applied this to rho equals rho code and to sigma equals rho A tensor some reference state. So I'm not sure if this is maybe this is happy for you, but it's certainly maybe unorthodox states. But I, yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. I mean, I agree. So in particular, in this case, I'm allowed to use this maximum mixed reference state. That's the self-special. Yeah.
The reason I'm asking is because sometimes we like to have states which are in ADS-ART contacts, we like to have a reference state which has symmetries, for example, the ground state or other interesting symmetric state, and they may not be mimicked by product states involved.
I agree.
Depends on how coarse-grained this is.
They never are actually product states. They are highly physical states.
They are not exactly, and if you coarse-grain them sufficiently...
Yes, this is on the level of the code in quotes, right? It's sort of, maybe if you choose your insertion site, sort of well spread out, there's some... I mean, all these, I guess this model sort of, even this model somehow, starts breaking down. If you ask it, two UV questions on the work, I guess. let's maybe stick with this for a little bit. So that's basically the point. Like you can sort of use this to argue that in fact there's a good sort of channel that you could define locally from the entanglement match to the boundary. You apply this relative entropy, and then you can interpret the relative entropy assumption as a statement about approximate monotonicity of. And then you get a recovery map that will depend on this choice of reference state. Yes.
So just as a chair, I should maybe really check what your plan is, because it could continue for quite some time. So one option is, I think, because there's nothing planned for tomorrow, that we essentially now come to a point where it makes sense to conclude and maybe have a short discussion tomorrow. But I understand you may not be around tomorrow.
I mean, maybe if you give me...
I mean, how much time would you need to...
Maybe if you give me two or three more minutes, I can sort of wrap up at this point, and then if people are more interested, I'm happy to talk more about later. It's basically what I was planning to do.
Oh, so you're close to the okay.
Yeah, if that's, yeah. So I guess I wanted to sketch like why this is true, so this was sort of in the last part, but maybe I'll not do this. But you know, if you stick around, I'll be happy to talk about it. It sort of, yeah, it follows sort of very, very quickly from from playing around with Stein-Spin relations and so on. But maybe the one thing I'd like to say is actually why we have why the solves this approximate entanglement reconstruction problem, at least in the weak sense. So this is just like two lines, but right, because somehow this was a statement about states, but we want to turn it to a statement about operators. So that's what I would like to do, and then we can conclude, and that's all right. So this we don't need anymore, I don't think. Okay, and maybe I'll repeat what I said here just so that it's more readable. So the conclusion that we got is that approximate preservation of relative entropy is implied in the entanglement vectors or between entanglement and boundary subsystem implied that, so this was our conclusion, that R of, there exists some map R. It's a map from the boundary to the bulk subsystem, right? Such that R of rho A is close to rho little a for all rho code. Okay. This is my statement about these reduced densities of rho code. Okay. So now, what you do is now you can propose a formula for these boundary operators as follows. You just say, well, OA is just the adjoint of this map, of this recovery map R. So this is a map from operators on the entanglement vector to the boundary. Do this, okay, and then of course it's going to be true that trace of OA, rho A, okay, this R dagger, you move it over there, then you have R of rho A, which is rho of little a, is equal to a trace of phi A rho A. And this is equivalent to weak recovery. I guess these are approximates. This is now approximate because R of rho capital A was approximately equal to rho of little a. So we have approximate or robust version of weak recovery. Now we have a special prescription for this map, right? It's not just some arbitrary existence statement, there's a concrete proposal. In particular, it's given by a completely positive unital map. So this one can now use to actually boost the statement a little bit. One can say approximately preserve two-point functions. This is very interesting. And it's an open question to me, at least, whether this can be leveraged even more, rather than whether, you know, basically what we wanted to have here holds approximately. So that's one question. One thing I want to say, maybe what's interesting is, well, there's this explicit formula that we learned from Omar, but we can also think about this in terms of this quantum version of a log derivative. And basically the interpretation is roughly the following. If you choose this reference state to be maximic state, then basically what you do is you take this reference state on the bulk, it's like a sum state on the code subspace, you perturb it slightly by this bulk operator, you look at the corresponding boundary modular Hamiltonian, and you calculate the response. You basically calculate the response of the boundary Hamiltonian to perturbing the reference state by phi a. This is exactly what the formula for OA that is predicted by this quantum Bayes rule. Okay, so this is sort of a physics interpretation, which I think is interesting. So it's sort of a response of boundary modular Hamiltonian to this perturbation where you change sigma code to sigma code plus t times phi a. Okay. This is for a particular choice of sigma in this recovery story. So maybe that's interesting. Many questions. So this entire story I should have spoken about. Okay.
And the point is that the K is determined by the reference state, and that's why this map depends on the reference state.
So when I say this, I really mean I take the reference state, I perturb it slightly, I map it out to the boundary, I trace out and do minus the logarithm, right? Just looking at the this is a function of this indeed. Yeah, so it's not in the vacuum in the fixed state, that's right. So corresponding to this bulk state. So yeah, slightly perturb the bulk state, I look at the change in the boundary modular Hamiltonian.
On the reference state, the reference state is in general some maximal entangled state, but does it actually depend on the entire reference state or just the part of the reference state on the A side, which you get by tracing the rest of it?
A priori, it depends on the whole thing, because we don't assume that some of this mapping is local, right? This isometry somehow is a global thing. The reference state actually that I take is a completely unentangled one. I take a maximic state one. But then I perturb it locally. Yeah.
So I see. The point is, KA obviously depends only on part of the state.
In retrospect, right? Like, right. But you don't know which. You'd like to say it only depends on this phi A part.
But the perturbation might depend on the part of the state outside the entanglement wedge, even though the. The effect.
Oh yeah. You mean like it could also change A bar in some sense a priori?
I'm trying to understand if in the end this is all just contained in the entanglement wedge, or whether the response of Ka to this perturbation in the entanglement wedge does in fact depend on the reference state outside the wedge as well.
Maybe posteriori, you learn that it doesn't matter. Intuitively, if you calculated this response without knowing that the relative entropies were exactly preserved, it could depend on anything.
Right.
If this is preserved, then it does not. Quite right. Then it doesn't actually depend a lot on what goes on in the boundary on the other side, and then this is a good way of calculating a boundary operator equivalent to this bulk operator.
Right. So the conclusion at the end is that it doesn't depend on.
It doesn't depend in the situation where this is a useful formula. That's right. Yeah. If this is true, then there exists a recovery map, and this is a good prescription, and then it does not depend on actually what you do with it. That's right. I could have spoken a bit about algebra, so all the story generalizes to finite dimensional algebras, which is interesting because somehow you'd like that this constant term, this Takanagi term, is not just a constant but an expectation volume operator. You'd like to see something like the area fluctuating a little bit. So this is something you can model by algebras, but I will not talk about it. So I'll stick around and maybe you can ask me questions. Thanks.
The approximate weak recovery, do you know any example in which the operator you got is not a strong, is definitely not an approximate strong recovery?
To be honest, I have not played around with it enough to say so. So I'm not sure what's a good way. Somehow we haven't tried to cook up take an erasure code and modify it a little bit to make it approximate and then see what happens. That's a great question. It's also, it might be that, this is sort of a particularly nice formula for O of A, but of course, there's redundancies, right? Like, you could choose many implementations of O A probably. Maybe even on a single boundary subsystem A, probably there's more degrees of freedom. So there could be some realizations that don't do the job, and there could be others that do the job, possibly. Good and bad OAs. Right? For example, here, the statement I made before is basically, you could write down ones that are not obviously supported in the code subspace, so where these OAs are not preserve the code subspace, but then somehow I can run an argument that shows that there's another choice, for example, given by the PETS map, for example, given by your construction, or possibly that's the same, in fact, because, at least on the code subspace, those are the same. Which satisfies the strong property. So in the exact case, somehow we know a way around. In the approximate case, I think that's an interesting open question. Likewise, maybe another last open question I want to mention is, so this trick kind of, right, so here I use basically the following trick that there's a map that takes states on a subsystem and extends them to state on the entire code. I think such things do only exist basically when you have tensor factors or direct sums of tensor factors. But for some general subalgebra of like some other type, I think such state extension maps do not exist. Normal state extension maps do not exist. So it's an interesting, it's a non-trivial question of how you would, some of this reduction of this approximate recovery result to the this result by et al. Sutta and friends. It's not obvious. So for the, you know, for these phenomenal algebras, so, you know, if someone.
Like not only is it not obvious, but also it's not true. Like, you simply cannot have tensor products exist in this quantum field theory.
No, but I mean, what I mean is,
if you give me.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Matrix, you're giving me the full state.
You could hope for another way of extending states, no? Like a way that takes a state on a reduced system and you can extend it, I don't know, right, to a state on the full, a functional on the whole algebra. And the, but the point is, you I think you cannot do it in as a normal map somehow. It's like this kind of like continuous and completely positive extension. Michelle probably knows this only exists for I think type one or like the, yeah, these finite sums. So that's sort of maybe an interesting sort of obstacle to us just reducing this to like a general statement on the other side.
You didn't use the independence. It was just a way to...
Yeah, so indeed. So I just need a map. Well, I think I need a map from row A to some row codes, such when I restrict again, I get the same state back. So it's like a dual of an adjoint of the restriction map, kind of. Well, not an adjoint, yeah. You know,
it has to work for all possible states.
It has to work for all states on the subalgebra. Yes. And I would like it to be a quantum channel so that I can, you know, compose these quantum channels and define E. I would like it to be CPTP, and I think this does not exist in general. Yeah, but which seems like a stronger statement than that there exist no product states, right? Because you could do it extended, you could always extend it to non-product states, but you can do it in a completely positive way, somewhere in a nice consistent way. Normal. Yeah.
I can ask later.
Yes, I don't know whether I made up a question, but I'm understanding for the last one.
Okay, so everything so far was in this context of having the static bound geometry and the given time slice, but of course when we defined the entanglement wedge, it was a very specific polydimension zero region in the bound spacetime. So now the statement that you can recover bulk operator within the anywhere within the entanglement wedge by the system, would that, do you know if that actually works?
I mean, I guess the way I would like, I would think one sets it up is by looking at the subalgebra corresponding to all observables supported in the entanglement wedge, like in the proper sense. And then if somehow, in this sense, the relative entropies are approximately preserved, everything should be fine.
So that would just
Ignoring things that these are not, you know, finite dimensional phenomenal algebras and so on. Ignoring technicalities, I think the general setup would still be fine, but we would go beyond this. Right? We wouldn't assume that there's such factorization. For example, we'd work with a subalgebra corresponding to observables supported in the entanglement wedge. I mean, that's the way I think about it. Maybe.
So this discussion doesn't have to be static. You just focus on a given time slice.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, yeah. So I interpreted static as saying this. Yeah.
We can argue about whether FLM has been proved in those cases.
Right. What do you say this?
It's published on FLM.
Okay, that's. I understood that there was also sort of an independent proof where you wouldn't. I mean, well, when you say FLM, do you mean this statement or that the modular Hamiltonians are roughly the same?
I meant that statement.
Really, with entropies?
Yeah,
okay.
Modular Hamiltonian statement also follows from that one.
Yeah, they're all.
Yeah, no, but somehow, but that's, I think, another interesting question. So somehow this implies that the modular Hamiltonians are the same. But, you know, if you restrict to the code subspace, say, and then this implies. Well, if you compare log rho little a and log rho capital A, V-dagger log rho capital A.
Oh,
yeah. So you project your boundary modular Hamiltonian back into the bulk, and you compare it with the bulk modular Hamiltonian. It's like bulk equals boundary modular Hamiltonian slope, right?
That's an interesting
little bit of Well, not a priori, right? You don't, I mean, the full balanced symmetries are related, but this is a statement about the subsystem density matrices. It's like I don't know, it's basically K of little a.
Sure, sure.
I don't know, something like this, I think, right? Maybe there's a constant, I'm not sure. So then this implies that the relative entropies are preserved, but somehow this error actually I only see how to do when it's in exact equality. Because like people use the first law of entanglement, so you take derivatives. Like suppose you actually only took the real Takanagi. So you said that was an approximate version. I actually don't know how. That's maybe another how to prove an approximate version of this. So we have if this is approximately true, you get the relative entropy statement pretty directly, I think. So that's actually, I think, another sort of an interesting sort of open question that you can study perfectly in this abstract scenario. Basically, are these equivalences correct even on the approximate level? Many of them are sort of, and it's easy to see, but this particular one, I'm not sure how to do.
I would suggest that we continue the discussion maybe during lunch or after. Thank you very much.